Justice, and today is March 26th. I saw this graphic today, and I thought it was really quite interesting because the decline in buybacks that we had in 2020 was certainly something that a lot of people were worried about, and that it had a deleterious effect on the majority of markets. But we can also see that this year, that even though we're only a quarter in, the number of buybacks has surged higher, and it's in fact, if not making new highs, pretty close to doing that. And that's, I think, it certainly surprised me that buybacks have rebounded in such an emphatic fashion. It's also, I think, worth considering that buybacks have been quite high since 2018, and they've been a fundamental backdrop to the strength in the stock market. And I think this is also something that we're probably going to be looking at for quite a long time. When we think about the outlook for the stock market, then the S&P 500 has begun to rebound in here today, and it was up about 1% earlier. It's right in the region of its all-time peak, and so far the pullbacks have been particularly modest. And if anyone was thinking about, well, why is the stock market so steady, despite the fact that bond yields have been rising, and they have certainly taken a toll on the NASDAQ, but less so on the S&P 500, and not at all on blue chips like the Dow Jones, where the Dow has continued to bounce from the upper side of the underlying range. Well, buybacks have got to be part of the answer. If we think about the constituents of the Dow and the S&P relative to the larger constituents of the NASDAQ, well, neither Google nor Amazon have been particularly big on buying back their shares. Apple has, but Apple is also a constituent of the Dow. And then we can think about all of the other constituents and their reliance on buybacks ahead of the pandemic, and then the fact that they are coming back into the ability to buy back shares. And that was also part of what Jay Powell had to say this week about the banking sector. So banks are going to be able to start paying dividends again, and they will also be potentially able to buy back their shares as well. So the S&P 500 Banks Index rebounded pretty emphatically from its intra-week lows this week. So this is still looking like a recovery overall. And we're also seeing that the yield curve spread has really remained quite steady. And I think I'm just going to make the charts bigger. The yield curve spread is still trending higher, and there hasn't been any real evidence that it has stopped just yet. This is being viewed as a growth promoter, that the bond market continues to view this as growth territory. They're paying less attention to the fact that it is usually as bond yields rise that it puts pressure on the market. But this is a very different scenario than we have been conditioned to expect, because certainly when we look back at past cycles, the inverted yield curve was a lead indicator. It was equally a lead indicator on this occasion. And central banks tend to respond with a lag. So then you get this rather gradual process of the yield curve expanding. And on this occasion, central banks were ahead of the curve, and they were cutting interest rates before the full magnitude of the pandemic was truly apparent. So they've perhaps brought forward the recession and additionally cut short. The chaps over at while, because this is not the first time that the price has gone sideways. So the question, of course, is, well, what is driving this? Well, obviously there was a big step higher in the price because of online retail taking over in 2020, and also because of people migrating to the cloud, and Amazon's AWS is the biggest provider there. So Amazon got a double hit of benefit from the pandemic. Well, we're starting to see companies like Shopify, for example, which has defied gravity for really quite a long time, is now back below the trend mean as well. That's a clear failed upside break. It has now broken its sequence of higher reaction lows and is right in the region of the trend mean. If we start to see it trading below $1,000, well, that is going to represent a big psychological Rubicon. There was a while that Shopify was the largest company in Canada, and that's no longer the case. It's now down to the second largest market cap in the market, and Canada's banks continue to be among the biggest companies in that market. Canada is on the cusp of moving towards tapering, and it's taking a toll on shares like Shopify because it has a clear need for continued access to cheap liquidity. But it is promoting the banking sector, and the banking sector represents a large weighting in the TSX, so the TSX index is continuing to march higher. But of course, the other big international index that has got a large weighting of banks is the ASX 200 in Australia. Now, Australia isn't talking about tapering its quantitative easing just yet, but the banking sector does do better when there is the potential that there is a wider yield curve. And when we look at that Australian 10-year yield, it is also marching higher, or at least it has been marching higher for the last few months. I do, however, think that we are due some pause and consolidation in this move in bonds, and that could be something that could rescue some of the most heavily burdened companies that really depend on low interest rates. When we look at the 10-year Treasury future, well, we've had a loss of momentum. We've had this was in lower territory in here today, but there has been a loss of momentum. It was challenging the sequence of lower rally highs yesterday. We're starting to see it pulling back again in here. That's so far so, and then it's still a downtrend. And definitely we've seen in the last 24 hours that people have used any kind of rally to continue to push it lower, which is why shares like Amazon have been weaker. But then we have the fact that the dollar is starting to appreciate. And where this, I think, is a rather different scenario than we've seen for a while. In fact, we've perhaps never seen anything like this in the currency markets before, because what's happening right now is that investors are willing to look at the dollar or look at any other currency and not so much judge it on interest rate differentials or money supply or the health of the economy, but rather just look at having one of the strongest currencies in the world, and they are willing to do something about it. So then we have this, I think there's the determination under the Xi administration that China would rather be feared than loved. I think I saw that on an article somewhere, and I think it's really very accurate, because we're starting to see this. I wrote maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago that everyone was going to have to make the decision eventually whether they were going to be willing to shut up and get on with dealing with China, or whether they were going to speak their minds. And this is particularly relevant for corporations, because Nike got into some trouble this week, and they are now attempting to backpedal on their statements about Xinjiang. The share was up in here today, so there's the potential that their contriteness might follow through. Adidas also pulled back right and it did not bounce today, so it is now below the trend mean, and there has certainly been a loss of momentum over the course of the last 6 months in the region of the previous peak. H&M certainly doesn't need to make enemies in China, and particularly since the share had been trending down for years until 2018, it looked like it was on a recovery trajectory right before the pandemic, and then it gave up its entire advance. It's now surmounted that 2020 peak, but the question is, will it be able to hold this 200 crown level? Certainly the way that Inditex is approaching this issue with Xinjiang is to erase any mention of it. Until quite recently, they had a portion on their website talking about their commitment to human rights and sourcing materials in a human rights friendly manner, and they talked about Xinjiang cotton. Well, that's now been erased, so the share has started to stabilize. So on the one hand, investors are looking at these brands and thinking, well, they should do well in a global recovery overall, but then, of course, they will also be looking at the fact that some of these companies are also going to be thinking about how they can expand around the world. And for Inditex, well, then they don't particularly rely on China. So even there, there's the scope that they will continue to benefit from a European recovery and a US recovery, and I guess more of a Latin American economy than specifically their reliance on China. So even though that they have the ability to really avoid any kind of big business issue, they've chosen to not ruffle the feathers of the Chinese administration. Of course, Australia hasn't been that lucky, and the Chinese iron ore sector is looking at trying to wean itself off of reliance on Australian iron ore. So they are really betting on the Simandou project in Papua New Guinea. Of course, that project has passed through any number of hands, and the fact that companies like Rio Tinto and others have been pushed out means that China will, on a governance basis, where there is nobody asking questions about how they got access to it back home, well, they're going to be able to boost their production of iron ore from that sector. But we're also looking at the potential for a significant rebound in global economic activity, and particularly as the U.S. moves towards full vaccination, then the number of vaccines in production and the number that will flow out around the world is going to help to really get confidence back, but it'll also bring the determination to get growth back, and that's positive for all kinds of infrastructure projects. So boron mining in California is their primary business, but it looks good on the press release. And I think that's rather impressive. One thing that is also likely to be of interest to the mining sector is Resolute Mining's determination to develop an autonomous mine in Mali. So they're going off to Africa to develop this mine, and they anticipate having at least 80% of its production from totally autonomous mining. The mining sector generally has been right at the forefront of developing autonomous trucking, because it was a very predictable route for the majority of trucks. So they've been doing that for a long time. Whether Resolute Mining will in fact be able to follow through and bring that mine to production, particularly in an area where the key rationale for allowing mining is to employ the domestic population and to bring high-paying jobs to very rural areas, that's open to question. But it is quite likely that it's mining is where we're going to see the first evidence of autonomous production. And certainly the number of robots is likely to increase substantially. We're also seeing that in terms of autonomy and really excising the market from dependence on high-cost labor, then 3D printing of homes is also a trend that is beginning to accelerate, and the number of companies that are doing that is also increasing, and particularly with the construction of affordable housing. Then we can think about the number of robots that are being developed to work in restaurants, because as minimum wages rise up towards $15 in the USA, particularly on the coasts, it's almost already there, then the willingness of entrepreneurs to trial and invest in these kinds of solutions will only increase. Certainly, when one walks into a McDonald's these days, the number of people still working in there or taking orders has declined considerably. Whereas once there was somebody standing at the counter, now there's a whole range of touch screens to make your order and to pay. So that is removing the need for a person to stand at the till. It's also streamlining the cooking process, and the share continues to trend higher here. Then, of course, Yum Brands is also investing in this kind of streamlining. In fact, they have done a really quite impressive job of appealing to a younger demographic. There was even this talk over the last few months of Yum Brands producing a gaming console that had a built-in chicken warmer that it was going to warm your fried chicken while you played games, which it sounds fanciful, and it, of course it is fanciful, but it was certainly something that sparked the imaginations of the internet and the Twitter groups, and it's the kind of thing that appeals to younger people. Of course, this whole I think digitization of interest in various themes is one of the reasons why people have been so interested in Bitcoin. And Bitcoin was up almost $2,000 in here today, and it has at least rebounded from that psychological 50,000 level. I would, however, caution that this trend is no longer consistent. If we just simply look at what the consistency characteristics of the trend were, well, the most clear consistency was that we had a sequence of higher reaction lows. We also had the sequence of ranges, one above another. Every one of these ranges was completed with a very emphatic upward break. And every one of those upward breaks was sustained. And the last big and substantial upward break was back into the underlying range. So that was the trend inconsistency, because it hadn't done that before. And subsequently, it pulled back yesterday to break a midpoint danger line. Midpoint danger line stops are really only appropriate in the most consistent trends. And this was one of the most consistent trends develop when you have a wide imbalance between supply and demand. And that has certainly been the case with Bitcoin. It has surged higher because of this continuing demand to benefit from the halving, which occurred last year. And looking at history, it has done spectacularly well following those halvings. So that was the initial rationale. Then, very similar to 2017, there was a lot of retail interest, so it was fueled by these significant stimulus checks coming out of the USA, and at the beginning of institutional investors started to come in, where you had companies like Square and PayPal beginning to take Bitcoin. So that was certainly part of the rationale for buying earlier on in this year-long move. Then we've had the introduction of institutional investors buying for speculative means. Then we had Tesla deciding that they wanted to buy. And of course, then we've had successive rounds of stimulus. So that has been an ongoing support. And that has helped the price go from 4,000 to a high in excess of 60,000, which is spectacular by any stretch of the imagination. And that's all wonderful as long as the trend is consistent, because as long as the rhythm is there and the cyclicality of the moves, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. But when the market becomes less consistent, well, the one thing it tells us is that that imbalance between supply and demand is no longer apparent, or at the very minimum, it has changed. So certainly Bitcoin has steadied from the 50,000 level, but this is a much less consistent trend overall. In order to clearly demonstrate that we are back in a demand-dominated environment, it will have to sustain a move above 60,000. And then 60,000 would become a hard floor subsequently. So the big question is now, how far will this rebound go? And will it subsequently take out the 50,000 level? If it takes out the 50,000 level, well, then we've a completed top formation, because it will have also broken the sequence of higher reaction lows. And then it opens up the potential that we are going to go right back down, not test the 200-day moving average, but instead think about testing the 1,000-day moving average, because that has been the point at which support has been found on successive occasions. And right now, that coincides with the $10,500 area. But Bitcoin is a speculative asset. It doesn't mean that blockchain isn't something we need to pay attention to. how that translates towards the distributed ledger, that it allows individuals to participate outside of the conventional economy, and that is also the primary attraction of the cryptocurrencies and blockchain and distributed ledgers generally. It doesn't necessarily mean that Bitcoin is the solution. That's been my point for years now, almost a decade, was that I understood what the allure of Bitcoin and the blockchain was, but I just didn't believe that Bitcoin would be the ultimate solution. In that regard, I still regard Bitcoin as the equivalent of Netscape. Netscape still exists. It's the Firefox browser. It's completely free today, but it was completely usurped by Chrome. So that is a potential risk. I don't think that Bitcoin is going to disappear because the governments of the world outlaw it, although that is potentially a challenge, but rather that it will simply be usurped by something better. And there are legions of developers that are extraordinarily smart people working on projects to do exactly that. And eventually some of them will be successful. So then we can also think about the performance of Ethereum. It's certainly the largest of those competitors. But the instrument did not push on to a new high, so it has a lower high now, and it was weak yesterday and recouped some of the loss in here today. But it has a lot of work to do in order to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. The big question, of course, is will the dollar and its potential to rebound on the back of a swifter pace of vaccine rollout be able to curtail, or will it prove to be attractive enough to for global investor flows to come back towards the US into dollars and start buying bonds? The big difference between Canada and the USA is that the Canadian Central Bank is saying, well, we have enough of this. We introduced a lot of emergency measures, and we're now going to stop using them. And we're looking at how to taper and return to normal. The Federal Reserve has repeatedly said that they don't care about asset price appreciation. What they want is full employment and outsized growth. And until they get it, they're not going to raise interest rates. So there are, of course, two arguments. Well, one is that U.S. growth will be certainly supported by this very accommodative monetary policy. And that's part of the reason why the stock market is also firm, as well as those buybacks. But of course, then we're eventually going to come to when the USA will have to start paying back some of these debts, and higher bond yields obviously start to put a crimp on that. So the question then is, when are we going to see enough of stress manifested in stock markets and asset prices to really motivate the Federal Reserve to alter their course and begin yield curve control? Because the dollar is certainly potentially going to do somewhat better because of the USA's continued acceleration in vaccine rollout. But I do think that that is something that is probably only a 1 or 2 month phenomenon, because as the U.S. approaches capacity, then everywhere else will catch up faster, probably with U.S. help. And then the rebound in the dollar may not have legs. Well, then of course the focus of attention would turn back onto the bond yield and the willingness of the Federal Reserve then gold will be, I think, under some pressure until we have a clear determination and evidence that negative real yields are going to remain the case. We still have negative real yields. The inflation rate is still, I think, quite likely to have upward pressure because of supply constraints and low productivity among manufacturers. So there will be outsized demand. There'll be some pricing pressure. The Federal Reserve is betting that that will not last. We've also seen that the blocking of the Suez Canal has helped to support the oil price. There was news today that it will be at least a week before they have the canal opened up again. So oil prices can rebound from their recent low. I'm still very much of the view, though, that oil prices will not be in a secular bull market. I think when we start to think about secular bull markets, then that's when we can really start thinking about the price breaking out to new all-time highs and multiplying from there. That's what a secular bull market means, that you will have a very significant pop on the upside and that the long-term range will be completed. So we are a long way from doing that in oil prices. I think before anyone even begins to think about a secular bull market, then we need to answer some questions. The first is, where is the supply inelasticity? Because most of the supply inelasticity that has driven the price back up from the lows in March of last year has been artificial. It's been OPEC restricting supply. And then, of course, there has been this massive fall-off in supply from the USA as well because of the drilling activity declining. But we went through a long period of investing in new oil capacity, and the world is trying its best to use less of it. And at the same time, we don't have to go out and find any more of it. The number of drilling companies that have gone bust is really quite phenomenal. Noble Energy has made a number of acquisitions over the course of just this week alone. They have been able to merge with others, and Noble has now merged with Chevron, but they also made other acquisitions in the, I think maybe not Noble Energy, but Noble Group made acquisitions in the offshore sector. So that tells us that it's not like all of the oil offshore has suddenly disappeared, but rather that it is just uneconomic to go out and drill for it. Well, if we had prices above $80, much less if they were back up to $100, well, the ocean's an awfully big place, and it's not like there's not oil out there. The pre-salt in Brazil, offshore in Africa, offshore both East and West Africa, and the Gulf of Mexico, these are all prolific areas for additional production and exploration. And if prices were higher, then they would be certainly drilled. And so there'd be a lot more impetus behind determination to build export terminals on the coasts of Canada as well. But we're just not likely to see a great deal of investment there because prices aren't high enough. So prices would have to move high enough to get the supply response, but it's not like the world has to go out and find them. Everybody knows where the oil is. They just have to invest in the production. It's quite the opposite with copper. Copper prices are on the cusp of breaking out to new all-time highs. And there is a realistic possibility that they will multiply from here, because it takes decades to bring a world-class copper-producing sector online. are doing well. But this is a lengthy range. The price of copper has been going sideways for 15 years. And we had a failed upside break in 2011, and it came all the way back down and halved in value over the course of the next few years, and now it has rebounded. There's obviously a reason for that. Well, it's quite clear that there is a determination by governments that they're going to fund their deficits by taxing carbon, and that they will then do to the energy sector what they did to the automotive sector. And we can think about that in terms of how Tesla has performed. Tesla was really lucky at the beginning in that the Karma car went bust. So Tesla was then able to appropriate all of the Californian carbon credits. What that effectively meant was that Tesla was subsidized by its competitors to build factories to put its competitors out of business. So that forced its competitors, like Nissan and General Electric, to build cars like the Leaf and the Cruze that were completely uneconomic so that they wouldn't have to pay Tesla to do the same thing. And Tesla's arbitrage of the carbon credits market has they've been able to peddle that into being able to build factories all over the world. They're just building one now in Germany to do the same thing to the German automotive companies that they did to the North American motor companies. That's the exact reason why Volkswagen announced over the course of just these last few weeks that they are going completely green. And they will no longer be investing in new internal combustion engine technology. So Volkswagen popped on the upside as soon as that was announced, because they are going to attempt to avoid having to subsidize Tesla's expansion in the region. Now we can think about, well, what's likely in terms of the challenge for the oil companies. We can already see that Rio Tinto has had the foresight to get rid of its coal, or to minimize its reliance on coal, and that they are trying to pioneer their investments in copper and aluminium rather than promoting the dominance of iron ore in their production, because they are trying to bolster their ESG credentials. You can then think about Royal Dutch Shell. They're probably furthest along in this transition away from a total reliance on oil. They produce more gas than oil. They bought British Gas in the last decade, so that further enhanced their ability to produce gas. Gas is at least less polluting than oil. Yet we're continuing to see that Europe in particular is pushing higher at the price of carbon. Emissions remain on this secular bull market for the simple reason that they could easily multiply, because it's a complete political imperative. So if we're looking at where taxes are going to rise, well, we can clearly see that carbon taxes are already well on the march, and that it is the oil companies are going, and the big polluters like the heavy industry are going to be forced to fund the ambitions of the renewable energy sector. And it's not a mistake that Europe has approximately 80% of all of the major wind companies, whereas it does not have the major energy companies. Obviously, Europe has energy companies, and outside of BP and Shell, the rest are big players in the global energy sector. The wind sector, however, is somewhere where Europe truly does excel, and the wind ETF is now bouncing from the region of the trend mean, because it's looking increasingly eye of the Chinese consumer falling on them, or how willing they're to kowtow to the demands from the Chinese government, and they're making exactly the same determinations about how they are going to kowtow to the demands of the renewable energy sector and the demands for action on climate change. So these are significant challenges for portions of the market. It's likely to benefit others. And of course, behind it all, you have the continued march higher in yields. And the big questions that remain outstanding are is this a real change? Is growth going to give way to value? Will small caps continue to outperform large caps? I think that there's a reasonable expectation that that will be the case, although of course there is also going to be some backing and filling in that determination. There's also the potential that countries like India or Indonesia will benefit from the tug of the geopolitical tug of war for influence in Asia between China and the USA. The Indian market reaped